freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it on to our children in the bloodstream. The only way they can inherit the freedom we have known is if we fight for it, protect it, defend it, and then hand it to them with the well-taught lessons of how they in their lifetime must do the same. And if you and I don't do this, then you and I may well spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it once was like in America when men were free.
Welcome back, everyone, to Patriot Coalition Live. I'm Matthew Nugent.
And I'm Jason Marocek.
Thanks for joining us today, everyone. Our goal is to create a timeless resource to teach about the U.S. Constitution and the proper role of government, the importance of America's Judeo-Christian heritage, and how to defend against threats to our nation. Folks, our email address is freedom@patriotcoalitionlive.com. That's freedom@patriotcoalitionlive.com. We'd love to hear from you. Questions, comments, or topics you would like us to cover, please send us a line. And we have sponsors. Remember, folks, that whenever you spend your time, attention, and dollars with what we call the three-headed beast of mainstream media, big tech, and big business, you are empowering them to exert tyranny upon us. We've seen it all over this last year, and we're going to continue to see it. But when you spend your time and attention and dollars with companies that love freedom and share the same values and principles as you, you empower liberty. So please visit us at patriotcoalitionlive.com and visit and support our sponsors. Okay, y'all ready?
Yes.
Let's do this. Okay, today we're talking about Article 1, Section 2, which is about the House of Representatives. Okay, recap. We are in Article 1 of the Constitution, which deals with the legislative branch. Now, it is the longest and most important article of the Constitution because when we enter into a civil society, laws are the foundation and the morals of the people, okay? In other words, the most important part of our country, other than its people being a moral people, is having moral laws, okay? Now, examples of immoral laws is laws which attempt to restrict our Second Amendment right to bear arms and to defend ourselves against tyranny. So imagine, you got a bully fighting a little guy and you take away this, you tie this little guy's hands behind him and he just gets pummeled by this tyrant. That's what taking away Second Amendment rights does. And it's wrong. It's immoral. Okay.
Yeah.
Also, here's another immoral law, laws which protect a person's ability to murder their children in utero. It sounds like an oxymoron, protect someone's ability to do something bad. Well, that's a representation of our society today. So the difference between moral laws and immoral laws is a life and death issue. Now, on our most recent episode about the Constitution, we discussed Article 1, Section 1, which told us that only Congress shall have the authority to make laws for our central government, and Congress shall consist of two branches, the House of Representatives and the Senate. Today's episode, we'll cover Article 1, Section 2, which covers laws regarding the House of Representatives.
Yep, that's right. So this section of the Constitution has five clauses. Article 1, Section 2 has five clauses. It starts with, how our representatives are elected. It talks about what the qualifications of those who elect them are. How many representatives we're going to have in Congress, what to do if there are any vacancies, and then how they elect their leaders and their authority to impeach public officials. So
if you're ever at a party and you want to sound really intelligent, or you're ever at the dinner table, you're like, impeachment, isn't that Article 1, Section 2? People will say, who do you think you are? Or maybe he knows what he's talking about. Or maybe she knows what she's talking about. And they'll like, no. Nah. And they'll be like, ask the internet. Goodness, it is Article 1, Section 2. And that's what we're here to help you do. Sound intelligent at dinner parties.
That's the whole point of this podcast. Make sure that you sound super intelligent in parties. Yeah.
Yes. So when the leftists say, no, you don't know what you're talking about, they're like, he's talking about the Constitution, guys. So anyway, I digress.
That's fine. All right. So let's dig in. So Article 1, Section 2 in Clause 1. So this is the clause that deals with how our representatives are elected. And it reads like this: the House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. So it's a little bit of a mouthful, but we're going to break it down a little bit. Mm-hmm. So the first half of the clause is pretty straightforward. The people in the states elect the members of the House every 2 years. That's pretty straightforward. Although it originally was 3 years, right? And mm-hmm. they decided that 3 years was a good amount of time. But then the Southern states were, because they're more sparsely populated and they were spread out. Let me back up. Actually, the Northern states wanted it to be just 1 year. They were turning over their representatives every year. So they wanted short time. But the sparsely populated states, because it was more costly and took more time to conduct the elections, they needed more time in between elections. So they wanted 3 years, and they ended up settling on 2 years.
Could you imagine if we had elections for representatives every year? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I mean, you wouldn't fatigue. Get it. Yeah, totally.
Honestly, here in Texas, it's almost that way. We seems like we're always having elections. But anyway, so that's the first half. It talks about, you know, we elect our members every 2 years. Mm-hmm. The second half, this is where the wording gets a little bit funny. It talks about the electors, right? The qualifications mm-hmm. of the electors. So an elector is simply someone who casts a vote for a candidate for public office. So if you are a voter, you're an elector. So clause one tells us that in order for someone to vote for a candidate in the House of Representatives, they have to have the same qualifications as someone who votes for a state representative in their state. So they have to have the same qualifications. You know, whether it's a state representative, a delegate or assemblyman, you know, different states call it different things. So mm-hmm. actually, so they have to have the same exact qualifications. Now, this is the first instance of several, actually, in the Constitution that grants authority to the states on the subject of national elections. So it actually defers to the states.
That's right. So states are in charge of their own elections. But this says there must be the same standards for the House as it is for the lower houses. And now when they say lower houses, okay, so that means different state, you know, call the lower house differently, state representatives, delegates, and assemblymen positions, as different states call their representatives different things. Okay.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. You know, so it just has to be the same, right? So whatever it is to elect those, whatever the qualifications are, it's the same for the U.S. House of Representatives.
There you go. So, and here's a little bit about the dialogue. Kind of like behind the curtain at the Constitutional Convention. And a credit to Jason, he did a ton of research on this. So appreciate that, Jason. You guys, I mean, to dig through these notes, and I've seen him do it, he basically went through the notes from the Constitutional Convention. You know, it's not your typical, you know, late night reading, unless you're Jason Marocek, you know, in which case we are the beneficiaries of. So, In terms of who should vote, you know, eventually all, you know, naturalized American citizens and citizens born in the United States can vote who are the age of 18. But it started something like this. Now, mind you, most people at the time who were in the leadership, a lot of them still had the monarchical or, you know, the monarch minded aristocracy ideas. So what's your gonna experience here that we share this with you, just a little snippet of it in time of how they thought back then. Now, you do not go from a total aristocracy to an individual sovereign nation where every individual is their own sovereign. But this is what it looks like. And for a type of revolution to take place, it's incredible that we landed on our feet. And it was quite providential. I mean, it says throughout our Constitution and our founding documents that God was definitely there. And for many revolutions, the country does not land on their feet, but we did and we had prospered. So John Dickinson said only landowners should vote. Think about that. Only landowners. And this gentleman, Morris, now his first name, it's gouverneur. It sounds French. I don't know, but it's a really strange.
For the longest time, I thought they were misspelling governor, and he was the governor of some state. But that's not the case. That's his first name.
Yeah, and back then there wasn't really a dictionary. People just spelled their names differently until Webster got literally. Until Webster actually had a dictionary, hence Webster's dictionary. So Governor Morris, I'll just say Morris, okay? Morris should said, if you give voting rights to the poor, they will just sell their votes. Because his rationale was, since they haven't worked for anything, they wouldn't appreciate the privilege of voting and they would just sell it, okay? Which is interesting because, you know,
interesting parallels to today, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk about, you know, folks who maybe when you have elected officials who are promising, you know, benefits to people if they will get their vote, right? It's not a direct transfer of money from one to another, but it's the same concept. Governor Morris actually had it right?
Okay. We'll go with that pronunciation. Now, take a look at Benjamin Franklin, okay? A religious man that we know. And he goes on and we're taking from what he has said in greater detail, because what he says has become what is more the more perfect nation of what we have today. Okay. And he says that the non-landowners and poor proved their value and character in the War of Independence. I'm paraphrasing, by the way. They fought courageously, selflessly, and hard. In fact, the British Army, the Redcoats, they said it was easy to track Washington's army because there was a trail of blood. It's not because they were just in a battle. Because, for example, when Washington's army was up north in Pennsylvania and New York, they made their own road. They didn't have shoes. They just wound them up. Or did they just bound them in cloth and they would have frostbite and they would bleed and there would literally be a trail of blood from the troops who kept on fighting. Okay. Their idea of a sick call, for those of you in the military, they say, you know, go to sick call or, you know, go to the infirmary.
Drink water, take Motrin.
You know, Ranger candy, Motrin, you know. For them it was, you still have got, you know, seven toes. We'll just, you know, and your shoes have kind of worn down because we've been marching 500 miles, you know, and we have no cobbler, no mender of poor souls. So we're just going to bind them and we'll just have to move faster than our blood trail will allow them to catch, which is basically what they did. So, I mean, Benjamin Franklin is saying, listen, and they fought hard and, you know, the non-landowners, which they equated as the poor, they can fight valiantly, which speaks to the truth, not my truth, but the truth, that there is courage and valor in every man and every woman. But there needs to be a right situation for it to bring out. And what these brave men and some women, with these brave soldiers had, is they had something to fight for. And that'll come into play here as we further explain this. So, and Benjamin Franklin also tells a story. He recalls a story of 1,000 American sailors, 1,000, okay, who had been captured and who were in English prisons. And the English tried to bribe these captured American sailors and say, hey, we will pay you, we'll pay you extra if you, you know, serve in the British Navy. And they said no. Now, listen, you know, prisons back then, you know, they probably had as many rats and vermin in the prisons or even more than they had actual prisoners, you know, which is probably good because they probably, you know, found a way to eat them. So it wasn't like, you know, you get three hots in a cot, you get a TV, access to the library and the internet. No. So they were in squalor positions. They were being half starved, if not starved. Surely they were being tortured. And I mean, it's an easy way out. These were brave, courageous men of character. Think about that. And they refused.
They refused.
Now, Benjamin Franklin also told another story of an English ship captured by an American warship. And these English sailors were given the opportunity to, you know, join the Americans, and, you know, whatever the Americans captured, they would share with them. And the English said, yeah, sure, we'll do it. Note, in England, you had to be a landowner. You had to be rich. You had to be almost the middle class, upper class kind of aristocracy in order to have skin in the game to vote. As a result, the big takeaway is that the English without the right to vote are nothing more than slaves. That's kind of what Benjamin Franklin said. I'm paraphrasing. And therefore don't have allegiance to a country. So Benjamin Franklin, who's very wise, I mean, he basically says, you know, if you want loyal people, you need to give them skin in the game. And here it means voting. And we have seen again and again and again how Americans, rich and poor, when they have, you know, a stake in their liberty and their freedom, will fight. And even in the most, you know, positions of great squalor, will maintain their loyalty. Whereas the English, who weren't given a stake in their nation and were not given sovereignty, said, yeah, sure. You know, slave, you know, basically a slave in England, or, you know, the opportunity for freedom and prosperity with America. And he was right. So
we saw how they made their choices. Yeah.
Yeah. So we know today, for our nation to have men to fight bravely and be loyal in the future, all people, rich or poor, need to be included in the right to vote. Now, but here's another big takeaway. This was a significant shift. You heard Governor Morris, and you heard, what's the other gentleman's name?
Oh, Dickinson.
Yeah, Dickinson, yeah. Say, no, you know, just the landowners, you know, and you know, Morris said, oh, they'll just sell their vote. You know, there are some people that have sold their vote, but you know, you got to give people freedom. You got to give people the right to make decisions of their own, even including the wrong decisions, but they can learn from them. Yeah. And we're better off because of that. So it was a significant shift from an aristocracy mindset and tyranny mindset toward the mindset of individual liberty, where each citizen possesses individual sovereignty in their lives and in their country.
Yeah. Yeah, no, well said. So clause two, if we're moving on, clause two, mm-hmm, talks about the qualifications of those who are going to be electors. Mm-hmm. So clause two says, no person shall be a representative who shall not have, it's qualifications of the House members, not the electors. It says, no person shall be a representative who shall not have attained to the age of 25 years and been 7 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state in which he shall be chosen. So this one is pretty straightforward, right? You've got to have a minimum age of 25. You've got to be a citizen of the United States for at least 7 years, and you've got to live in the state that you're going to represent. Now, notice that you don't have to be a member. You don't have to be resident of the district that you, mm-hmm, represent. And in fact, sometimes, you know, politicians will determine, okay, what's the best district I have a chance of winning an election? Yeah. They'll run in there, and then they'll move their residence there. So you don't have to live there. So and interestingly enough, the concept of citizen, you know, it says a citizen of the United States for 7 years. That word citizen wasn't really defined, at least in the Constitution, until 1868, when, mm-hmm, they ratified the 14th Amendment. So at this point, they all just knew what they meant by a citizen.
There we go. So clause three, the number of representatives. Note, there are some changes here, because the 14th Amendment, which talks about citizenship, Jason mentioned that, and the 16th Amendment, which has to do with taxing by income rather than population. Okay, we'll get into that more later. But, quote, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. Now, this portion was superseded by the 14th Amendment with citizenship, and the 16th Amendment which changes from by state to by income. Now, you heard there are three-fifths. There's a big discussion about that. We'll get to that a little bit later, touch on that. It deserves more, but we're going to touch on it just a little bit, okay? Now, the rest of this clause is still in effect today. Quote, the actual enumeration, meaning census, shall be made within 3 years, which first census was in 1790, after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States, and within every subsequent term of 10 years in such manner as they shall by law direct. The number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000, but each state shall have at least one representative. And until such enumeration shall be made, meaning until the census shall be made, the state of New Hampshire shall have, you know, choose three electors in representatives. So it goes on to list every single state. Now, that's where they started. And at the first time they declared this and wrote this, it was for every 30,000 people. Obviously, that has changed. There no more representatives are being added. No more senators are being added unless there's another state that enters the union. But
unless the Congress, because they didn't say how many exactly, they just said, you know, they cannot exceed one for every 30,000. The Congress is allowed to make the laws that determine how many representatives there are. So they could technically change it, but they haven't changed it for a while.
So I don't see that happening unless another state gets added, in which case that would be two senators. Yeah. And then based on the census, they would have to reapportion all of the representatives. Okay, so now note, today the only purpose intended in the Constitution for the census was to determine the number of representatives, or is to determine the number of representatives each state shall send to Congress, which also is the number of representatives, of presidential electors. So how many electoral votes are there? There are the number of House of Representatives plus two senators for each state. Okay. Right. So actually, except for Washington, D.C., which, you know, they don't have senators, I don't think, Jason. They just they do have a couple representatives, though.
There's three additional electors, one for D.C., one for, I think, maybe Puerto Rico, and one for Guam. I don't remember the third one. Yeah. But it's basically 538. So there's 535 plus the three territories. Okay.
There's also the U.S. Virgin Islands, but last I checked, they don't have a representative. So, but anyway, so the number of electoral votes is the number of representatives plus the number of senators. Okay. So constitutionally speaking, the only thing you need to answer on a census is how many people live there. Different laws may change, but the census has basically gotten out of control, but that's just something to be mindful of.
Yeah. So as Matt said, you know, the first sentence of this clause has been superseded by the 14th and the 16th Amendment. So, but it does refer to the three-fifths clause, or some people refer to it as the three-fifths compromise, right? So contrary to what you will hear from low information blatherers on television and the internet, this three-fifths clause, it was not an effort to dehumanize slaves at all or prolong slavery. Now, let's face it, they'd already been dehumanized the moment they were, you know, they had chains slapped on them and sold to another human being. They were dehumanized. So this didn't further dehumanize them. And that was not the point of the three-fifths compromise. Actually, the three-fifths clause was a compromise struck which attempted to encourage the Southern states to ratify the Constitution while removing any benefit that those states might incur in terms of representation for continuing to import slaves, right? So the Northern states, they didn't want the South. They didn't want what the South regarded as property to count for representation, but they also wanted those states to ratify the Constitution, so that they were in kind of this conundrum. Because other than Delaware had the fewest population, but South Carolina and Georgia were next, and they had really small populations. And so they wanted every advantage they could to increase their representation in the new Congress, which, you know, obviously included in counting slaves.
Yeah. So in fact, I think Jason, at one point, in fact, this was the most contentious, and people were about to get up and walk, and it was done. The Constitution, Constitutional Convention was about to end, and you know, we're done. We're done here. We're not going to have this. We're going to stick with
No, that's exactly right. Yeah. You know, in all my research of the debates, you know, this, they went back and forth on this quite a bit, right? They couldn't really come to an agreement. They couldn't. Yeah, it was contentious and it was very animated, probably the most animated part of the convention. And it was actually at this point where Benjamin Franklin, he kind of made his favorite quote, and I'll ask Matt actually to read it. The quote about the sparrow.
Okay. All right. Sure. Thank you. Quote, "I've lived a long time, sir, a long time. And the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain who build it. I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel," unquote. Note, the builders of Babel failed.
Yeah, so, they sure did. Yeah. So this was Benjamin Franklin, who allegedly, you know, didn't believe in a God, or at least was a deist. This is him saying, look, we're just men. We're not, this endeavor that we're upon, if it's going to succeed, we need God's presence. And so he's basically intervening and saying, hey, let's take some time. Let's spend some time in prayer that we will be able to get through this. And it worked, right? They came out with a compromise that ultimately allowed them to move forward with the convention. And, you know, today, this three-fifths compromise, regardless of where it started, it was contributed to our Constitution and the abolition of slavery.
There we go. So bottom line, you're thinking, was the three-fifths compromise good or bad? Okay, here's the bottom line. It was a compromise. It allowed us to move forward with a new Constitution, which is our Constitution we have today, which ultimately contributed to the abolition of slavery. So when we look at our past and we say, is it good or bad? We have to look at the nuance. We have to look at the details. We have to look at the context, because, you know, to say three-fifths mean we only count three-fifths of the population or three-fifths of a person, you have to understand the big picture. And another question to ask is, well, what if we hadn't done it? Well, we'll get to that. Well, there are four parties, but here more parties, but here are a few that we needed to address in order for our nation to progress. In the Southern mind, the compromise gave the South some representation from slave ownership. I know it's hideous, but you know, we had to go through that. And it did minimize some of their tax burden, because back then, states were taxed based on the number of population for the population number for that state.
Yep.
So they had to count their slaves for both paying taxes and for voting. So they wanted some, I know it's terrible, but that's just how it was. In the North, the three-fifths compromise reduced the South's representation in Congress. Okay. And it discouraged using slavery as a means to gain more representation, meaning, hey, go get more slaves. We can get more power in the House of Representatives and continue with slavery. So, I mean, yeah, it's now to the United States, it meant they could move forward with a new constitution, which, by the way, later contributed to the abolition of slavery. And it allowed us progress towards a more perfect union. Okay, the founders of our nation, Declaration of Independence, Constitution of the United States, they knew that our nation had problems. And the Constitution, one of the most precious documents ever written after the Bible, it takes account for man's you know, shortcoming, sinful nature, and for our ability to grow. And that's what we've done. 245 years, and it's going to be 250 years.
Yeah.
5 years.
No, so. It's you know, this whole concept of the, you know, the way they crafted it, even from a practical perspective of, you know, how do we move forward? How do we not let this fall apart? And I know you're going to go over some details about, you know, mm-hmm, what mm-hmm. would have happened if we didn't do this, but it was a brilliant compromise.
You got it. So what would have happened without the compromise? Okay. There wouldn't be a constitution. We would have been under the Articles of Confederation, which, as we have mentioned in the past, it was basically a treaty of 13 different countries. So without the Constitution, we'd be under the Articles of Confederation, which opened the door to other countries coming in and developing or you know, getting into treaties with France, with England, which would have torn us apart. And at the time, England, you know, King George, in England, they still had slavery. Remember, only two of the 11 states wanted to keep slavery, Georgia and South Carolina. So there wouldn't have been the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, okay, abolishing slavery, giving citizenship, and giving the right to vote to all Americans, respectively. The United States would have broken up into two different countries, primarily one pro-slavery and one abolitionist nation. It made the best of a very bad situation, moved our country forward, which eventually led us to become an exceptional nation.
Yeah.
So, and you know, the brilliance of a good compromise is not that it solves the biggest problem. It moves us forward towards a better solution in the future.
Yeah, it's not perfect. And by definition, almost, there is no perfection because everyone wants different ends.
Yeah. So if you have an elected official and you look at their voting record and you say you voted for this, you know, leftist minded piece of legislation, and you know the voting records are as they are. However, you really need to get context because it's critical to understanding the big picture. Okay. So now clause number four.
By the way, that just as an aside, that's not an excuse for anybody to vote for unconstitutional to acts, right? So mm-hmm. we still have to have our elected officials still have to have principles
yeah.
in terms of mm-hmm. what they're voting for and what they're not voting for.
That is true. That is true. Yeah. And how about this? Principles should the, what, that's another conversation. When do principles, the abolitionists, there were abolitionists in the North that allowed this compromise to go on. Did they have principles? I think so. You know, mm-hmm. Benjamin Franklin, you know, George Washington, they were part of that crew that, you know, wanted to get rid of slavery. So the founders of our nation, were they evil men? No. Were they humans? Yes.
Yep.
Were they sinful men? We all are. And, you know, God allowed us to create something great from us sinners, which is incredible.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. So clause four, vacancies in the House. Quote, when vacancies happen in the representation from any state, the executive authority thereof shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies, unquote. Basically, the governor orders a special election and you know, some congressmen and senators, they live a very long time in this context. We're talking about House of Representatives.
Yeah. So if someone dies, they, you know, decide they resign, whatever, whenever there's a vacancy during their term, the governor just gets to hold a special for their state gets to hold a special election.
Yeah. And it happens a lot. So order a special election. There wasn't much debate about that. Clause five, leaders and impeachment, quote, the House of Representatives shall choose their speaker and other officers and shall have the sole power of impeachment, unquote. So the House of Representatives chooses their own speaker of the House, not the people. Okay. Now note, it also means that they can choose a non-member of the House. Although it hasn't happened yet, it is constitutional for the House of Representatives to say, hey, we love this businessman. We love this business, you know? So if the House of Representatives really wanted to, for example, vote for Trump and make him the House of Representatives Speaker of the House, they could. Will it happen? Yeah. I don't think so.
The language allows for it. It doesn't specifically prohibit, you know, just a random person. It doesn't say they have to pull it from their members. So technically it could happen.
Yeah, it could. It hasn't happened yet in history.
Yep.
But all that happens now on impeachment. Now moving on to impeachment, is to politics what an indictment is in criminal law. So an indictment basically says when someone is successfully indicted, it means there is enough evidence to try someone for a crime, okay? And it works like this. The House writes the Articles of Impeachment, which is the case for why the official should be removed from office, okay? So they're writing the Articles of Impeachment. They're putting together for the quote-unquote indictment. And the Senate acts as the jury. So they send their Articles of Impeachment to the Senate, and the Senate the Senate writes the rules and dictates, okay, this is how we're going to set up this impeachment. And these past couple of years, we've got to see two, you know, which are shams. You know, we now know how it, or the reasons for these two impeachments were shams. The Senate acts as jury and votes guilty or not guilty, you know, which if found guilty is the person in office is removed from office. Now, it does take a 2/3 vote of senators. It's a very high standard. 67 senators out of 100. Okay, so.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about the Senate side of that when we get to Section 3, which talks about the Senate.
So
in short, right, the whole impeachment, all they're doing is saying, hey, is there enough evidence for this official to be removed from office? And the House is only deciding on is there enough evidence, and then they move it over to the Senate.
There we go.
Yep. Well, that that pretty much covers everything that we're going to talk about. And we've talked about Article 1, Section 2. Again, that deals with the House of Representatives and all five clauses, right? So we talked about Clause 1, which is how the representatives are elected. Clause 2 is what are the qualifications of those representatives. Number 3, how many of them can there be, right? We talked about how that is determined. And again, this was, you know, the most contentious part of probably the whole convention, because everyone wanted to, you know, this is the most important thing. Who gets to make the laws, right? So they weren't going to just back down. They wanted to make sure that they were represented well. So how many of them are there? That was Clause 3. In Clause 4, it talks about what happens if we have vacancies in the House of Representatives during their terms. And then finally, the last clause talks about, you know, how they elect their own leaders within the House, and you know, what their power of impeachment is. So again, this section on the House of Representatives, I mean, it's the people's house. And so that by necessity, they had to spend a lot of time on this to make sure that they got this right, because this was going to be the basis. This was also how, you know, remember in the Articles of Confederation, it was just the states who had one state, one vote in the Continental Congress. Well, now they've expanded that. Not only do the states have a say in the national government, but now the founders reached down and said, okay, we're going to give the people directly a say in what happens. We're going to give them skin in the game in what happens, and not just, as you know, we've talked about their state having a treaty with the other states. So this was important stuff. And so hopefully you've picked up some things, and we're going to move on into other sections of the Constitution here in the future. So great job, Matt.
All right. You too, buddy. Okay. So folks, thank you very much for joining us today. Remember, please visit and shop with our sponsors at PatriotCoalitionLive.com. Remember, we have an email address, freedom@PatriotCoalitionLive.com. If you're not already a regular subscriber, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast, places like iHeartRadio, Spotify, and where you normally get your podcast. Thanks again, everyone. We'll see you here next time.
See you next time.
Bye now.